Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. This week, I'm joined by our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello, Matt Matem.
Hello. And this week, we're going to be hearing from the stars of the new Marvel television series, Agatha All Along. That's Catherine Hahn and Joe Locke, as well as the creator, Jack Schaefer. Plus, we'll also be reviewing new films, including The Substance, Strange Darling and The Goldman Case, plus discussing some upcoming re-releases. But before we get onto those new releases, have you been watching anything else this week, Jamie?
Well, I've been treating myself to a couple of seasons of films like I always do, Matt. So my current seasons are I've been re-watching all the Jenna Rowlands movies that she made with John Cassavetes, her husband, because obviously Jenna Rowlands passed away in August. There's an obituary on her in the latest issue of Total Film, one of the great, great actresses. So I haven't, you know, I watched these Cassavetes films years ago, so I've gone back to them, and she did 10 with him. I've watched about 7 so far, like Gloria, A Woman Under the Influence, Opening Night, Love Streams, just incredible work she did with him, and I've got sort of 2 or 3 more to go. So that is one of my seasons I've been doing. And the other one is I'm currently, just for my own amusement, working on my top 100 films list of all time. So I've just been going back, and a lot of the sort of great films I saw in my 20s are kind of films you get in the canon. A lot of them I've rewatched many times since over the years, but there's a handful, or, you know, well, more than a handful, that I've probably never gone back to in like 20 years, that I watched them all when I was ticking them off lists in my 20s, and I've not seen them since. So all those ones I've only seen once and want to kind of reevaluate, I've been going back and trying to watch those again. So stuff like Duck Soup, 12 Angry Men, Letters to an Unknown Woman, Journey to Italy, there's a whole group of them, which, you know, if you go on any sort of list of the greatest films of all time, they'll probably be hovering around. So I've been doing that as well. So I've been balancing these two seasons, and then obviously trying to keep up with all the new releases as well. So non-stop, Matt, non-stop. What about you?
I haven't watched much else this week. One thing I did watch, which we're going to talk about properly next week, so I got my dates wrong. I thought it was this week at first, but is My Old Ass, which I loved that, but we're going to talk about that properly next week. So that's a next week film. Annoyingly as well, I did the classic thing yesterday of seeing a film, but being heavily NDA'd on it, so can't even really mention what it was.
I know what it was.
And
you
do know what it was.
Yeah.
But one other thing, Jamie, that we've both seen a little bit of that's starting this week is The Penguin, which is obviously on the cover of the current issue of Total Film. And you obviously wrote the great cover feature there.
Thank you.
But what did you like? I have only seen the first episode at this point. You've seen a couple more than me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, without going into kind of full review territory, what should people expect from that?
It's what you'd expect in that it's a spin-off of The Batman, because, of course, Colin Farrell's Penguin was in The Batman, the Matt Reeves film. But he's only in sort of 6 or 7 scenes, although he makes a big impression. But in this, they've kind of brought him to the forefront, and it's set directly after The Batman, a week later. So after the city's been flooded by the Riddler, and there's a power vacuum because Falcone is dead, and it's who's going to take over as the kind of head of the underworld. So you've got various crime families and figures trying to muscle their way to a top. And one of these is Oz Cobb, Colin Farrell, the Penguin, who he's a very sort of sly Machiavellian, one step ahead of a game player. And he kind of is trying to maneuver his way to take over the underworld. Where it's interesting is it's very much belongs in the Batman universe, and the nighttime scenes look very similar to the Batman, with that moody gothic look and very stylish. And then the daytime scenes, which there aren't many daytime scenes in the Batman film, they've got a slightly different, more sort of gritty, handheld look to them. And as much as it's in the Batman universe, it's very much a kind of crime drama series that goes right back to gangster movies, Warner Brothers gangster movies in the 30s and 40s with James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. And, you know, it's indebted to stuff like Long Good Friday and Scarface, kind of rise to power. And it's a really intriguing, complicated, psychologically deep crime drama, as well as everything else. Colin Farrell's great in it, as several other characters who are fantastic and really attention grabbing. Like you say, I've seen sort of, I think I've seen 4 episodes, but so far I've really enjoyed it. It's really good and it's violent as well, dark and violent.
Yes, I've only seen one so far, but it was very much, I was very much into it from that one episode, and we'll definitely be watching it when it, continues. And that is starting this weekend in the UK on Sunday on Sky and Now. So yeah, look out for that. That's The Penguin. And obviously read more about it in the current issue of Total Film. But on to this week's new releases now. And first of all, The Witch is back.
Agatha.
Who's been messing up everything?
The Covenless Witch.
It's been Agatha all along.
No. What really happened to you?
Seekest thou the road to... So this is Agatha All Along, which is the spin-off from Marvel's WandaVision, and this is following Agatha Harkness and her road back from the events that took place in Westview. We are now going to hear from creator Jack Schaefer and stars Catherine Hahn and Joe Locke from when online entertainment editor Emily Murray spoke to them last week.
Darkest hour, wake thy power, earthly and divine.
The Witch's Road will give you the thing you want most if you make it to the end.
The road is a death wish.
Heard you guys were having a party.
What's up?
Hey.
Shall we?
So this is obviously a spin-off from WandaVision, but also it definitely feels like it's very much its own thing. Can you tell me a bit about balancing, I guess, continuing WandaVision's like tradition, I guess, but also ensuring it's something fresh and new?
I mean, that was the challenge. That was the thing keeping me up at night at the beginning of this process. For me, it was about, diagnosing what was special about WandaVision, what did resonate, what was fun about the watch, and trying to capture those things, but give them a fresh spin. And I think part of the fresh spin on the show is, we're really immersing in witch culture. The Scarlet Witch is a witch by name, but Wanda knows nothing about witches and witchcraft in a real cultural way. And so that's what this show is, the opportunity to dive into that. And then, of course, Agatha is so different from Wanda. She is so unapologetic, and there's no hesitation from Agatha to be a full-throated witch at every opportunity. That's really the thing that sort of spins it away from WandaVision.
I feel like we have this show because fans loved Agatha so much. As soon as Catherine Hahn stepped into WandaVision, that was it. We were in love. So I'm just wondering, what role did fans, I guess, play in helping shape this show direction? Because I also imagine you got inundated with fan theories during WandaVision.
Yeah. Well, so the fan theories themselves don't inform like the actual plotting that I do or that Marvel does either. I like to think about what is the thing people are engaging on? Like, what is the thing that's sort of lighting them up? And is it the thing that's lighting me up? Like, that's where I feel that I'm successful and my team is successful, is when we can find that sweet spot of we're excited about it. It's giving, it's making our brains tingle and making us want to dress up, and also having that effect on fans.
I read before that you said you wanted Agatha All Along to never be a redemption story. But even though we have to like sort of emphasize with her, understand her, like she is still a villain. So why was it crucial that I guess we didn't fall into a redemption arc?
I hope I was quoted correctly, because I think what I said was is that the question is it a redemption arc story? Which you have to watch the whole show to get that answer. But what I will say about that is it was never the goal to make Agatha soft, to turn her into like a full-bodied hero in that sort of true blue way that we see in other Marvel properties. It was very important to embrace everything about her that is selfish and cunning and duplicitous and self-serving, because the goal was always to see the full person. And so we had to let her be nasty.
She is very nasty. But like, unlike other villains, like she's not after world domination. As you say, her goal is much more selfish. To me, it feels like lower stakes, but I guess it makes it more intimate. Like, would you agree with that? Because it's lower stakes, we guess we can get maybe closer.
I absolutely agree with that. And I say that a lot, that like, the reason I'm able to attach to Agatha is because she's not interested in some global, you know, I'm going to like snap and have half the population of the universe go away. Her intention is not to hurt people. She actually never is like, I just want to hurt this person for hurt's sake. That's not, that doesn't interest her. What interests her is power. And she will hurt people in her efforts to get power. I agree with your, with using the word intimate. There is something intimate about that because she has to kind of like slither around and she has to get close to people, especially at the top of the show when she has no power and she's really on the back foot. She's clawing her way out, and so she's got to cozy up with a lot of people she wouldn't normally want to be next to. And I think the show is intimate across the board. All the relationships are very kind of close quarters and very emotional.
What I do love about this series, even though it's about witches and we're in the MCU, it feels like, well, it's about a woman trying to find her power again, yeah, and trying to reclaim her voice that has got lost. And I feel that's so relatable. I'm wondering, do you relate to that?
Absolutely. My whole tenure at Marvel has been about women and their relationship to their own power. And it's something that I am dealing with on a daily basis. I'm, you know, I am a creator and a showrunner. I'm a mom. I'm a friend. I'm a partner. You know, these finding your own power in all of these spheres is a constant challenge. And especially with Agatha, you know, she operates often out of ego and hubris, which is a side that I didn't get to explore with some of the other characters I work with. You know, Wanda's expression of her power was subconscious. She wasn't actively trying to hurt people and take a town hostage. She sort of did it obliquely and then had to reckon with it. You know, Agatha has this abandon that I find fascinating. So yeah, it is really close to my heart, this sort of constant conversation that I have and that I have with my friends and the people who are close to me. This show really explores that. Every single character is on a journey of trying to connect with their inner power.
And it's women supporting women. Like, she finds that through her coven and through the sisterhood. So what do you hope the show says about sisterhood, I guess?
I hope what people take from the show is yes, there's a tremendous amount of benefit from the circle, from the tribe, that you can have communal power and you can find your own internal power in that circle. But also it was really important to me to show that there can also be infighting in a circle and there can also be, you know, bad decision making and backstabbing and the complexity of these witches not being able to get along. The goal for them is to harmonize, both literally and figuratively, and they fail at it, you know, on a number of occasions. And so it's sort of that. It's like a circle can give you so much, but it's always going to be an imperfect thing.
Agatha All Along is Marvel, but it does feel different. So I kind of wanted to ask you a bit about superhero fatigue, which I feel like is a phrase we're talking about a lot these days. Like, what do you make of the whole phrase superhero fatigue? How do you feel about it? And how would you say Agatha fits into that conversation?
There's so much conversation and rhetoric about Marvel. I follow it because, you know, I'm part of that world. Everything ebbs and flows, right? Like, it's all just one big pendulum. So it doesn't rattle me or freak me out, and I don't know if it's there or not. I think it speaks to that audiences are always craving originality. You know, every story is the same story. We're all kind of doing the same thing. But what is the fresh filter we can put on something? What is the POV that we can center that hasn't been centered before? And that's what I think is different about our show, is I think it's a group of characters that normally don't get the spotlight, and they do in this show.
Yeah, in terms of the comic books, because I know you're really engaged with those as well, what would you recommend people read sort of in conjunction with a show, like any particular comic book series?
You know, this show really was a departure from the comics, whereas WandaVision drew from the comics a little bit more. I've said this in press, so I can maybe stop feeling so sort of clenchy about it, but I'm not a big comic person. I rely on my colleagues at Marvel to fill in. I would say there's no real like comic required reading, but you know, the influences on the show, maybe you might want to check out things like Wizard of Oz and Neverending Story and Labyrinth and Princess Bride and The Craft, Suspiria. I mean, anything with witches. It's the witchy season.
So obviously you've played Agatha before.
Yes.
But you know, this is her show. This is Agatha All Along. I'm just wondering, what is the biggest thing then that you learned about her that was new whilst making this show?
The biggest thing I learned was, you know, I dare even say it because she would want to vomit, but you kind of see a little bit of what makes her the way she is underneath all of that. You know, when you see her without her power, it's an opportunity to see her exposed. You get to see her, what made her the witch that she is.
What was it like when filming the musical sequences, especially when you were next to, like, Patty, etc.?
Oh, I had to just be like, la, 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 because she is a goddess. But she's also so welcoming, so supportive. You know, we all were really team players. Like, this whole thing, you had to be.
I love the different vibes, especially I've seen first four episodes, episode 3 and 4, like, there's a different aesthetic for each episode, different costumes. Mm-hmm. Do you have, obviously without spoilers, but a personal favourite?
I really love the road look, her first one with that coat. I think that is, like, so stunning. I love that coat.
I love all the different characters about me, and Aubrey Plaza's Rio really stands out to me.
Yes.
And can you tell me a bit about filming the first scene of you two outside of the Hex? Because it is feisty.
It's very, very feisty. You know, we know each other through Parks and Rec, but we've never had a chance to work together. We were kind of ships in the night, but they're some of my closest friends, the women from Parks and Rec. So we've seen each other a bunch socially, but this was a whole nother level to work like on something like this with her. And it was so fun. It was so fun. And we didn't really talk about it. We would send each other music and poems. But like, you know, we really kind of kept to our own corners until it was time to shoot the scenes. And so I think all that like coiled energy really worked in our favor.
Yeah, it unleashes when you're like fighting each other. Yeah, I love that scene. So you said you sent each other music and poems. Like, what sort of stuff was that then? Was it all, I guess, witch vibes?
No, it was like just stuff that kind of subconsciously or consciously was the right vibe for whatever the history of this relationship was. Because they have a, you know, clearly a very long and complicated history.
One thing I love about this series is that obviously it's about witches. But also this is about a woman trying to rediscover her voice, rediscover her power, which I feel is so relatable. Is that something you relate to?
It's very relatable to, especially as a woman gets older, and even for young women, like the idea of like standing in your own body and your own skin and your own brain and feeling powerful is something that maybe isn't or hasn't been as accessible or, you know, prized for a long time. And so, like, you know, we are surrounded by incredible powerhouse women now. I mean, especially to girls and women and men that just don't feel that they have that power within them, that this is hopefully aspirational.
And Agatha, you know, finds that, I guess, through her coven, like through the sisterhood, through the support of other women. What do you feel that the show says about sisterhood?
I think it says that a coven does represent that kind of community where you can be completely yourself and not have to put on any other air or identity, or, you know, you don't have to like try to please people or whatever. It's so I think that's like true friendship, I think. And I'm going to include the amazing Joe Locke in that as well. He's incredible. And he's definitely a witch and definitely a part of this coven.
Talking a bit about Agatha's future, because obviously I know spoilers and whatnot, but do you have any personal hopes for where you would like to take the character next?
Oh, you know, this was such an unexpected surprise. I have no expectations. I know in the comics she touches on a lot of different worlds, but I know also that she could go anywhere because this witch is kind of her own bird out of the comics. Like, it's not a straight story. You know, Jack kind of created her from a lot of different elements of Agatha in the comics, so she could go anywhere.
In the comics, she did debut in Fantastic Four. Movie's coming out next year. I'm like, would you like to meet the Fantastic Four? It's Pedro
Pascal.
I mean,
I would love to play with that cast. They're all incredible. And Matt Shakman, who's incredible, directed it, who did all of WandaVision. So yeah, I'm very excited for that movie.
Yeah. What are you most excited for fans to see with this series?
I want them to see, and I'm excited for them to see, the practical magic of this show.
Yeah.
There's like very little CGI, and still there's magic, so much magic between these characters and the magic between the people, like you were saying, like Aubrey and I and Joe and all the witches.
So joining the MCU must be so exciting, but I'm wondering, like, was there a moment on set where it really like sort of clicked for you and you were like, I'm here, this is the MCU?
But, I mean, our show is very like, it's very different for the MCU. It still obviously is very MCU, but there are certain parts where we're very MCU, and I was like, oh cool, but I can't talk about this one, so I'll talk about the ones I can talk about. Which walking on the Witches Road set was the most amazing. I think that was the first time I really realised the scale of the show. You know, Heartstopper is a very small show compared to Agatha. The set was like the size of a football pitch, and they built this entire forest indoors, and it was amazing.
Yeah, because I did read about there's like definitely emphasis here on practical effects and practical sets rather than CGI. So how would you say that sort of aided your performance as teen?
It's nothing better than actor being able to act with the thing you're supposed to be acting with. Also just so much fun, like getting to do all these cool things and see these things explode and water and fire and everything is like, with it actually being there, it's really great.
I read that you had 9 auditions.
I think maybe I've overrated it with 9, but it was 7, 8, or 9, one of them. I need to count them. But it was a lot of auditions.
Were you ever at a point like, is this going to happen? Like, will it not happen? Because that's sounds quite exhausting.
I mean, it was over like a 6-month period, so it wasn't too bad. But it definitely, like every audition I'd get further in, they'd tell me more about the character or like send me a script or something. So by the end, I was like, I'm so invested now, I'm going to be so upset if I don't get it.
Yeah, and I absolutely love Teen. Like, Teen just made such an impact, I think. And the goth eyes and all that. So there is obviously a mystery as to who Teen is. I won't push you on that because I know spoilers. But I'm just wondering, how much do you engage with like fan theories online? Do you read what fans are theorising about your character?
Try not to look at too much online, because I think if you look at too much, you'll always find negative things. But I think what's so great about Marvel is like the ability for fans to have theories and theorize about different things. And also what's great about a TV series especially is that every week people are going to have new like theories and thoughts and what might this be. And I think that's one of the great things about Marvel is its secrets, and it's also great to know the secrets.
Yeah. WandaVision was such a hit, especially with, you know, the queer community. Mm-hmm. How would you say this sort of follows on from that and sort of like pays tribute to those fans?
I think it really does. Teen is a gay character, and that's a part of him and his personality and a part of the show. We have one episode where Patti LuPone dresses as Liza Minnelli, so you can't get more queer than that. Two queer icons in together, so it very definitely pays homage to that, whilst also paying homage to like classic superhero and Marvel tropes as well.
And how important is it, I guess, to have these characters like Teen, like who are just openly gay but it's not part of the plot or anything, it's just fair? Like, how important is that for the community?
I think it's almost like, I keep describing it as like the next level of representation. Like, we've had like these incredible shows that have put queerness to the front of the characters and the plot, and now it's like, great, and now we can have queerness just as a part of them. My Heartstopper obviously is one of those shows that puts queerness at the front of it, and not to diminish that at all, but it's great to have queer characters that are just queer, but also are all these other things as well.
I'm just wondering as well, did you have like any input in a sense of the character, in a sense of like the writing? Like, I'm just wondering if Jack came to you for like any advice on the lines, or what input did you have?
I wouldn't say so much in the terms of writing. I think Jack is the most incredible genius writer I've ever met in my life, and I even need to question anything that she does, because everything she does is amazing. But I definitely, they were really great in letting me have input into Teen's character, and like there's a bit of improv and you know, making him my own, which was really nice.
What was it like being improv, because you were literally next to like Catherine Hahn, Patty?
Catherine is, I feel like, one of the best improvers in the business, and so, but it was also like learning from the best. There's like one scene in the show that a bit of improv I did like makes it in. I was really like, when I watched it, I was like, yeah.
Tell me a bit more about working with Catherine, because I love the dynamic between the pair of you. It feels like Teen sort of slowly warming her cold heart, you know.
I think we had instant chemistry from our first chemistry read, and it just grew throughout the filming, which really emulates the relationship between Agatha and Teen as well. There's nothing better than working with someone who you feel so comfortable with that you can take risks. And if we're doing a scene that there's sometimes, you know, you work with certain actors who have very, like, they like their ways of their doing things, and you feel almost like, oh, I don't want to mess with their way of doing it. Whereas with Catherine, I felt like I could always be like, I'm going to try this complete curveball, this take, and this new thing, and she'd just run with it, and the same back. We felt so comfortable with each other, which is really nice.
I think that really comes across as well on screen. Why do you think Teen is so drawn to Agatha? Because, like, everyone hates her. Basically, everyone hates her except for Teen. So why do you think he is so drawn to her?
Teen is a big fan of witches, and she's, like, the most infamous witch. And so for him, I think he sees a lot of her coolness and her power, and sees, like, where other people may be a bit scared of her. I think Teen is stupidly not, in a very naive and teenage way, that teenagers often just take risks and do things that are stupid and look back and be like, God, how did I get away with that?
We haven't even spoken about music yet. And I feel like the musical element is such a big part of the show. I love the song. When you read that there's going to be music and you're going to have to sing, like, what was your reaction?
I was excited. I mean, I had no idea what to expect, other than that I knew that Kristen and Bobby were writing it, and they're obviously double egots, so you can't really get much better than that. They know how to write a good song. So I was just really excited. And, you know, to learn you're going to be singing with Patti LuPone is amazing. Terrifying, but amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it like filming those musical scenes on set then? Because, you're literally singing next to icons.
Yeah. I mean, the filming, it was the most terrifying part was recording the song, because we were in a recording studio and I think we did it in three sessions, but my session was me, Patty and Sashir. Patty went first and they're like, great, now Joe and Sashir, your turn. And we were like, well, there's no way we're going to follow that. So let's not even try and just have fun with it. It was amazing.
Yeah. Does Teen get a solo? Would you like him to get a solo if not?
He doesn't get a solo. And I, one day maybe, but I think he's happy with doing backup to all these other witches.
I love how, like, especially episode 3 and 4, which I've seen, both had different vibes, different styles. You sort of spoke about costumes earlier, obviously without spoilers, but was there like a favourite sort of vibe, aesthetic or costume that you had?
My favourite was actually the cabin episode 5 one, which I can't say because it's in the trailer. I just, the 80s, like, I had this like clip-on mullet and I loved it more than I think anyone else loved it. I think everyone else thought it didn't really suit me, but I loved it.
Is a clip-on mullet in your future for just, you know, regular, or just not even a clip-on, just a regular mullet?
I feel like Teen would definitely rock a mullet. I miss the eyebrow slit. I kept it for like 6 months after, and then everyone was like, is it not growing back yet? And I was like, no, but actually I was just shaving it every 2 weeks. But then I got to the point where I was like, I probably should.
In terms of the future, because obviously it is part of the wider MCU, do you have any personal hopes, I guess, for where you'd like to take the character next?
Obviously, I loved working on Agatha and I loved working with Marvel. And so I always find it funny, like, would you want to come back? I was like, duh, of course I would. I love everything about Marvel and so would come back in a heartbeat.
So that was Jack Schaefer, Catherine Hahn and Joe Locke on Agatha All Along. But I've only seen the first episode at this point. You can see 2 episodes on Disney Plus now by the time you listen to this. So it's starting with a 2-episode premiere. I've got to say, yeah, from the first episode, I was very much enjoying this. I'm a big fan of Catherine Hahn and really enjoyed her as this character. So it is good to have her back. And from, again, I'm just basing this on the first episode, but it's nicely intriguing and it does a really good job of kind of parodying a sort of detective show, the type we've obviously all seen loads of. But it does a nice job of like walking the line with kind of parodying it, being like a little bit funny, but not being out and out comedy, still getting a lot of the tropes and the feeling of it right. But there's some kind of funny credits and stuff you see in the beginning. The first episode, we're basically just introducing Agatha to the character Teen, played by Joe Locke, who we just heard from, and also kind of setting up this antagonism that she has with Aubrey Plaza's mysterious character as well. So it's kind of a setup episode, kind of getting her out of where she was sort of trapped at the end of WandaVision. But it is a very, very intriguing start. And what I liked about it as well was that it felt like an episode of a TV show, whereas sometimes with the Marvel or the Star Wars series, they can feel like a long film that's been chopped up, whereas this felt episodic, like it was a natural fit for TV. So I'm looking forward to catching more of that.
So is it, because I haven't seen it yet, but we'll be watching on Disney Plus, but is it quite similar to WandaVision in any way? Because the first half of WandaVision, I absolutely loved when it was really sort of clever and different and riffing on stuff. And then I felt it sort of became more normal and, you know, not as inventive as it went on. But what's this like in comparison?
The one thing I would say about it is, from just based on the first episode, the tone feels quite different to other Marvel stuff. And maybe not as immediately arresting as WandaVision was right at the start. But it feels intriguing. It feels like a nice kind of different flavour. It's almost got more of that like hocus pocus kind of vibe to it, the sort of having fun with the witches, than feeling classically sort of superhero in any way. It has that going for it, that it does feel different. And whether that will be off-putting to people who do just want a completely traditional Marvel fare. But to me, it felt like quite a nice breath of fresh air, actually.
Cool.
So if you fancy watching that, that is Agatha All Along. And the first 2 episodes are streaming on Disney Plus now. And next, it's time to pump it up with a new body horror.
Have you ever dreamt of a better version of yourself? Younger, more beautiful, more perfect. One single injection unlocks your DNA and will release another version of yourself. This is The Substance.
So, this is The Substance. Jamie, do you want to set this one up for us?
So this is a really stylish, arresting body horror movie, I suppose you'd call it. And it's about a fading, once Oscar-winning actress, Elizabeth Sparkle, played by Demi Moore, who now, you know, her kind of film career has dried up and she's an aerobics instructor. She's got a hit aerobics show on television, much like Jane Fonda, really, in the 80s. That seems to be the kind of model they're going for. Near the start of the movie, she gets laid off as this aerobics instructor, that this horrible guy who kind of is the head of the network, played by Dennis Quaid, a real misogynist. He wants to go younger and bring in someone more sort of young and beautiful and kind of up the viewing figures that way. So she gets laid off. So she's obviously feeling really bad about herself and where she is in life. And then she gets this mysterious message about something called the substance and decides to give it a go because it promises kind of that you can have a younger, better version of yourself. So she gets this kind of fluid which you inject into your spine. She gets it kind of delivered to her or picks it up, and she gives it a go. And what it does is it splits, this is very sci-fi, but it splits your cells and you kind of give birth to a younger, better version of yourself, and your original kind of body lies collapsed on the floor. And the rules of it is that this new young version can have a week where it can go out into the world and have a great time, do whatever it wants to do, but it's vital you stick to the rules. And after a week, you have to sort of return to your original body, and a younger version has a week off and the original version goes back in the world for a week. And it's really, really important you stick to these rules, like, you know, gremlins that you can't feed after midnight. So of course, what happens? They break the rules that the younger version, who is called Sue and is played by Margaret Qualley, she starts wanting more time in the world because she's having such a great time and doesn't want to go back to being Elizabeth Sparkle. So she starts breaking the rules, and from there stuff spirals out of control and it turns into this really kind of a spectacularly gory, messed up monster movie stroke body horror.
Yeah, it's one of those films that, like, we'll be saying this about the next film as well today, I think, but it does benefit from going in knowing minimal about it, I would say. And I kind of had that. I knew a reasonable amount about it, in part due to Jordan Farley's great feature in Total Film Magazine, previous issue. But yeah, I must say, I did really enjoy this film. And I'm a big fan of the kind of classic David Cronenberg body horrors from back in the day. And this obviously must have been influenced by those, and it's extremely stylish, so it's a film that's easy to get swept up in that way, because it's such a bold kind of garish world right from the start, and the music and everything, and just the whole tone of it. Something which I really liked about it is the way that this weird potion is set up. They give this very briefly sort of scientific explanation, and the very opening shot of the film, you see like a cracked egg kind of laid out in some sort of laboratory conditions, and the egg yolk gets injected, and then you sort of just see it kind of, again, basically gives birth to a another duplicate egg yolk. But it keeps it really simple, basically. Everything about it is kept simple. It's a really sort of straightforward. They don't get weighed down with exposition or anything like that. It's just this is what happens, this is what it does. So I kind of got straight into it for that reason. The only sort of slight downside for me is I actually thought it was a tad too long, because it's 2 hours 20 minutes, and it's pretty obvious where the kind of direction it's going to go in. And then, like I say, because it's all set up fairly straightforwardly and doesn't waste a lot of time with kind of waffle and exposition, I felt like it just went on a bit too long when you know the direction it's going in. I feel like you could have shaved off 20 minutes off this and maybe made it that little bit more satisfying for me. But how did you feel about the length?
I think maybe it is a bit too long, but it's got so much energy and fizz and pop through the entire film that it didn't really flag for me. And just when you're beginning to think, oh, this is going on a bit, it goes to a place, it kind of elevates itself to such a place of just extraordinary kind of in your face mayhem. The last 20 minutes is so mad. It's just absolutely bonkers in such a fun way that it kind of swept me through to the very end. But I did think it was absolutely great. I mean, it was obviously in Cannes and it got rave reviews in Cannes. There's a lot of talk about Demi Moore maybe being Oscar nominated, which I think she deserves. It's probably the role of her career and a very bold role, obviously playing on her own fame and her own age, you know, in Hollywood, which has always been very ageist. And even though, I mean, I do feel the kind of themes of the film we've seen a million times, it's very obvious in terms of aging and the pressures on women and, you know, the physical expectations put upon them and the kind of absolute torture that they have to do to kind of, you know, achieve that. So you kind of know all that side of it. But like I said, it's done with so much invention and excitement in this genre piece that makes it far more fun than if you did a straight drama on it. But I really enjoyed it. I think Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley are both absolutely great. And the director, Coralie Farge, French director, she did a feminist rape revenge film in 2017 called Revenge, which if you've seen that, you'll have a small idea what to expect because that's very stylized as well and very energetic. But this film, she kind of takes it up a couple of notches. I thought it was terrific. And the last thing I'd say about it is it's also a real return to those kind of prosthetic makeup effects that you got in the 80s, which was the kind of heyday for them, stuff like The Fly and Society. And if you're a fan of those movies, it really goes back to that. And they are absolutely brilliant, the effects. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, I love that. And it's interesting as well, because, I mean, in a lot of ways, this is quite a full-on film in terms of like the gore, primarily kind of nudity and, you know, sexualization and things like that. Very, very full on and in your face, so to speak. In some ways, it is you've got to be willing to go along with that. But yeah, there's something about it, like particularly in terms of the gore, because it has that sort of satirical, it's comedic kind of edge. I feel like there was something about it that was largely remained on the kind of funny or intentionally gross, like laughing along with it. Like, I don't know, did you feel that as well?
Totally. It's so heightened. It's like, you know, the scene in Kill Bill when Oren Ishii sort of runs across the table and decapitates that guy and the blood just hoses out of his neck up into the air. You know, it's that kind of tone, or early Peter Jackson like Brain Dead, where it's kind of a bit tongue in cheek and it's so over the top that rather than being, you know, make you wince or hard to watch, it's kind of just exciting and really funny. So I didn't have a problem with the gore at all. And the last 20 minutes, there is a lot of blood. I mean, gallons and gallons of blood.
As a balance, there were a couple of things that made me wince throughout. Again, and as is often the case with these things, it's often the kind of smaller things.
Yeah.
But I won't mention a later thing that happens, but one thing that happened really early on is when the person gives birth effectively to this genetic clone, that person then comes out and sort of takes over. So when Margaret Qualley's Sue has kind of come out of Demi Moore's Elizabeth, and then she's kind of the one who's conscious and, you know, living that life at the moment, Elizabeth's body's just there on the bathroom floor with this massive wound in the back that she has to basically stitch up. That made me feel pretty queasy.
Yeah,
that whole bit,
just the injections into the spine that they have to do each time they have to inject the fluid into the spine. So it's little things like that, and there's a scene with teeth that is really nasty as well, that really makes you wince. But the more sort of over-the-top heightened stuff is just played for laughs, I think, or enjoyment.
Another thing which I liked about it, I kept thinking of, I mean, maybe this is quite an obvious analogy, but I kept thinking of the portrait of Dorian Gray a lot throughout this, because it has that sort of, really feels like a sort of a modern take on that kind of fable, especially with the whole like picture in the attic and the here you have someone left in the bathroom, basically. And there's also this element, like you mentioned, the 7 days thing. And it's like, if they overstep that at all, then basically some bad things will start happening to the other side of the person. And so that made me think a lot of Dorian Gray. And then obviously it makes you think about a lot of those classic showbiz stories about, you know, aging stars with younger rivals.
Yeah, totally. All so about it. Yeah, stuff.
There's a lot of that about it as well. But in a way that felt kind of modern. And it's just very funny as well, I thought, in a lot of places. Just sometimes it's visually you know, physically funny, but there's just some funny bits in it as well. Like there's a really small character that just really cracked me up in it, who was a guy that Elizabeth runs into at some point, and he's someone who knew her at school.
Yeah.
And they just have this very funny interaction, basically. And so just things like that, I just really enjoyed about this film. But yes.
Yeah, that's a bit Groundhog Day, isn't it? That scene. Right?
Yes, very, very much.
Pumps into him. I also think it's vital that it's a woman director, a female behind the camera, because you mentioned the sort of sexualization there, and during the aerobic scenes and stuff where they're just in tiny leotards and pumping away, it deliberately does a very sort of male gaze. It kind of replicates the male gaze where there's loads of crotch shots and boob shots and bum shots. And, you know, it's all satirical, but if it was a guy behind the camera, it would maybe still feel a little bit, you know, icky. But with a woman behind the camera, it kind of feels okay to me. And it really feels that it's making a point about them. Male gaze and about patriarchal society and what it puts women through.
Yes, yeah, I mean, it'd be an exceptionally different film if it was directed by a man, for sure. But if you fancy checking that out, that is The Substance, which is in cinemas now. And now it's time for another horror film this week that's also not for the faint of heart.
This is a dramatization of the true story of the final known killings of the most prolific and unique American serial killer of the 21st century.
You know you asked for this, right?
Can you believe it?
Just trying to have a good time.
So this is Strange Darling. Jamie, do you want to set this one up for us?
So this is the second film by a writer-director called J.T. Molnar, and you may have heard of it because it's got a lot of buzz on Twitter. It played at Fright Fest to rave reviews. For a while, it was 100% on Rotten Tomatoes because it came out in America a while ago, a month or two ago. Stephen King tweeted about it, calling it a clever masterpiece, so it got a lot of headlines for that. Essentially, it kind of lives up to all the praise for me. That it opens, you get a bit of text setting up the story that there's been a prolific serial killer doing a cross-state spree in the United States. And what we're about to see is presented as the kind of final spate of killings in Oregon. And it's going to sort of show us what happens towards the end of this murderous spree. And the film is essentially a two-hander, that you've got the character of a lady played by Willa Fitzgerald, and the demon played by Kyle Gallner, who was in Smile, and a really good thriller called The Passenger, which came out in 2023, which you may not have seen. It's on Prime. I recommend seeing that. He's great in it. It's a two-hander between those two, and it's set up that you've got the serial killer, you've got the woman, you know, he's going after towards the end of his spree. The film is in six chapters, but the chapters are jumbled up. It's not chronological. So we start in chapter 3 and then the action jumps to chapter 5 and then to chapter 1. So it kind of takes us around and it drip feeds information, and there's loads of sharp left turns that you don't expect. It kind of toys with expectations and it's really clever. It's a very, very well acted, well scripted kind of serial killer thriller. And it looks fantastic as well. It was shot in 35mm by, of all people, Giovanni Ribisi, the actor. And he does a fantastic job. I think he's going to get loads more requests to get behind the camera because it looks terrific, like really lovely bright colours and moody and wonderful. And it's just it's a really smart, fun, entertaining, surprising, exciting thriller. I thought it was great. Mm.
I'm also on exactly the same page for this. And again, similar to what we're saying about The Substance, that I do think, I mean, even more so, this benefits from going in not really knowing too much about it. And I'd heard kind of good buzz about it when I saw it, but I didn't really know that much about it. And I heard buzz and I knew it was a bit of a sort of serial killer story. But then it was one that, yeah, I was just kind of arrested from the beginning. And I really came out feeling like invigorated when you've just seen, you know, a really just exciting new film, basically, that just takes you by surprise and that wasn't quite what you were expecting. Does something a bit different, just does what it does really well. Both the actors, again, I wasn't really particularly familiar with them. I'd seen Kyle Gallner in a couple of things. He was in the Scream recall from a few years ago as well. That was the only thing I was really particularly familiar with him from. And Willa Fitzgerald, I hadn't really seen in anything.
She's actually in a TV Scream, so there's a weird connection.
Strange,
there.
Yeah. But it was, yeah, it was just one of those things I was just really gripped by. And you obviously mentioned the kind of jumping around chronology chapters and things like that. That's something that it obviously has this sort of formal daring about it, you could say. And you have to, for me, you have to really get that right. Otherwise, it can just be a massive distraction and just massively off-putting. Like when people just add chapters unnecessarily into films, and then particularly when they jumble up the timeline, that can just annoy me at the best of times. But I thought this was just done really, really well, really confidently. And yeah, it's just like a lean, tense, really interesting film. Just really delivered for me. And just one of the films I've most finished recently and come out of thinking just feeling that sense of invigoration at having just seen something very exciting, and by someone like J.T. Molnar, the writer-director, someone who I haven't seen any of his previous work.
He's done one film before in 2016, so like 8 years ago, called Outlaws and Angels, which I haven't seen, and I'm going to go and track it down now. It's not meant to be as good as this, but I'm intrigued to see it. But this film, it's got a lot of people on Twitter. I've seen a fair few people compare it to Tarantino as well, which I get in that it's got the mixed up chronology. It's got some great needle drops, the dialogue. There's little bits of dialogue like someone says, like, your business is not my business. And there's two characters they bump into in this film who are called like Papa and Mama. And they're doing a kind of Scott Bio puzzle, so it's a bit sort of pop culture there. And there's even a little bit of foot fetish going on at one point. So I get the QT comparisons, but at the same time, it doesn't feel at all like kind of, you know, just ripping off Quentin Tarantino like some people did in the 90s, especially. It feels very much its own thing, its own tone. It's really well made with such confidence. And yeah, I really recommend it. Out on Friday, I'd go and see this if you can.
Yeah, the comparison, I agree there. It's just very much is about the timeline. It's 100% a fair comparison in that sense, I think. But when you actually watch the film, you don't think, oh, this feels like a Tarantino film or anything.
Not at all, no.
And I will also, just one little thing I wanted to add as well. This film also features, in terms of stomach-churning things, obviously eggs playing a small role in The Substance. This film features one of the grossest fry-ups I've seen on screen since The Greasy Strangler, so... Be warned about that as well.
This probably says a lot about me, but I quite like the look of that fryer. I was like, I may go and make something in a minute. I'm hungry now.
And again, a bit like, also, I mean, weird how these films just kind of come along and then you feel like the comparisons between them. But also, like The Substance, this is an 18 as well. And I would say it's a pretty, pretty strong 18. Kind of bear that in mind, if you will. But very, very good film. So if you do fancy checking that out, that is Strange Darling, and that is in cinemas now. And for the final film this week, The Jury is out on this one.
Goldman, Pierre, Bernard, né à Lyon le 22 juin 1944. Goldman,
les faits qui vous sont reprochés sont les suivants. D'avoir, le 19 décembre 1969, attaqué à main armée une pharmacie 6 boulevard Richard Lenoir à Paris. Homicide volontaire sur deux pharmaciennes, vous êtes ce qu'on appelle un insoumis.
Révolutionnaire dans l'âme.
Monsieur Goldman, peut-on vous qualifier de gangster?
Oui.
Et d'assassin?
Non, certainement pas.
So this is The Goldman Case, which is a French courtroom drama. And it's one that I went into this very cold, which I feel that perhaps a lot of people in the UK will go to, because the figure at the centre of this case, which is based on a true story, Pierre Goldman, is someone who I wasn't familiar with, but he's something of a bigger name in France. So he was the centre of this court case that divided a nation in 1976. So he's on trial because he's appealing the sentence where he's been imprisoned for these armed robberies he's been involved in. One of those led to the death of two women. There's this kind of incident in a pharmacy that led to two people's death. So Goldman is pleading not guilty on the charges of murder, although he doesn't make the same claim for the other kind of criminal aspects of his life. So you're basically really thrown in, and we get a small introduction where we see his two lawyers. They sort of meet in their chambers to have a bit of a discussion beforehand, and one of them, he's received a sort of quite an angry letter about the other one. It's basically where Goldman's basically saying he's not happy about this other guy recommending him. Goldman's Jewishness is a big part of the film and the case as well. And he describes this one of these lawyers as an armchair Jew. So there's this tension from them from the off. But then besides this opening little kind of prologue in the lawyer's chambers, kind of setting that up, and we get a bit of text on screen as well, kind of setting up just the bare bones of Goldman's backstory. You are then just thrown into this court case and you follow on from there. And again, especially if you're like me and you didn't really know much about Pierre Goldman in advance, this is where you learn about him taking the stand. He's something of a sort of left-wing activist, almost like a folk hero, almost like a sort of Robin Hood kind of figure, where he has very strong morals, despite the fact he's obviously broken the law a lot. But he has this really strong moral code. Like a big part of his case, he refuses to call any character witnesses because he basically is like, it shouldn't matter if people are testifying about my character or not. What should matter is that I'm just innocent of this crime that you're accusing. He's a very, very charismatic figure and he has these fiery outbursts. Yeah, and then you basically just sort of learn more and more about it as things go on, as new people are brought out to testify, as new things, new revelations occur, as they do in these courtroom dramas. And as such, one could argue that France is also being put on trial during this case with some of the stuff that just comes out about the police, racism, all that kind of stuff comes to the fore during this court case. I found this a very, very interesting, enjoyable, gripping kind of film, despite the fact I didn't really know much about it beforehand. But one thing that's really interesting about it, and a thing I really admired, is it's so stripped back in the way in its filmmaking. And it's shot in the kind of boxy Academy ratio, adding to this kind of claustrophobic feeling of just being inside the court the whole time and just not really leaving the confines of that building. We don't even leave in flashbacks or anything like that. There's no music throughout the film either. So fair play to them and fair play to director Cedric Kahn for, stylistic choice. So, just the complete opposite from the last couple of films we've just discussed as well, in terms of them being so stylized, this being so stripped back and, almost documentary-like. That's my feeling on the Goldman case. Jamie, did you like this one?
I did like it. It's very kind of like you said, it's very methodical and dry in a way, and documentary-like, but which kind of it took me a while to get into, but maybe it took a while to get going until, you start to have a bit more, the firebrand aspect when he gets up and does a bit of rebel rousing speeches and stuff. But it is, it's just really stripped back, like you say. It's put together very well. It feels very authentic. It's just really interesting in France at the moment that you've got this whole string of courtroom dramas that we had, Anatomy of a Fall, which won the Palme d'Or. We had Saint Omer last year. Now we've got this one, the Goldman case, and they all seem to be doing something different with the courtroom drama, that rather than be traditional Hollywood, if you take something like Few Good Men, where it's quite exciting and it builds and, it's a big sort of, you have those big melodramatic flourishes that you expect from a Hollywood courtroom drama. These films seem to be more about stuff like, motherhood and race and gender and religion and stuff like this. And like you say, this one is very much kind of putting France on trial. And even though it's set in 1976, there's definite parallels to today with all the division going on and, kind of anti-Semitism is a big theme in this film. And I just found it kind of really interesting and quietly gripping. Yeah, I definitely recommend it. I think it's one to see.
I feel like I perhaps would have benefited from knowing a bit more about the real case beforehand, which I didn't really know. So, and I hadn't realised quite what a big sort of, moment it was in France. And also, there is that element, because you're thrown in and because of the language barrier as well, there are certain aspects of the court experience I didn't fully grasp, such as they seem to have different levels of sort of prosecutor and things like that, which I didn't fully always grasp who was, making the final decisions and so on. But again, in classic style, you can tell who's on whose side, basically. So it doesn't look like it matters that much. But obviously there are kind of difference with the legal system we're familiar with over here, I would say.
It will be interesting to see how it does in the UK and internationally, because it came out in France last year and was quite a big hit, I believe, because obviously, you know, it's a case that people know about and it's part of the fabric of, you know, French society and whatever, that people for the last 40 years have sort of talked about this case, and he's a big figure. And like you say, over here, you know, a lot of people won't have heard of him, don't know it. So it'd be interesting if it translates. To me, it's more the kind of film, I think, in the UK that would get very good reviews and would play to a certain kind of art house audience and won't break out.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it has the breakout potential of Anatomy of a Fall, for example.
No.
And again, there's another strange connection, because Arthur Harari, who plays one of the lawyers in this, he obviously co-wrote Anatomy of a Fall as well. So just an interesting little connection there with these French courtroom dramas. If you fancy checking that out, that is The Goldman Case, which is in cinemas now. And also out this week, there's a lot of re-releases. So as part of the ongoing Batman 85 re-release season, this week we're now getting Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy and Matt Reeves' The Batman, which is, I mean, the latter is good timing for The Penguin, really, if you want to revisit that before starting on The Penguin. People don't need to know my feelings on the Dark Knight trilogy, just because I've banged on about them enough over the years, but I absolutely adore those films, and any excuse to see them on the big screen, I'm up for. How about you, Jamie? Are you kind of excited to revisit the Dark Knight trilogy, or are you going to be giving The Batman another go?
If I can find the time, I want to see all of them again on the big screen, because I think the Dark Knight trilogy, Nolan's trilogy, is absolutely great. And you know, you kind of forget now how much that reinvented Batman. That I recently went back and watched the original Tim Burton 1989 Batman, and you know, it's kind of so comic book gothic, and you've got the Joker, by, you know, played by Jack Nicholson, in his purple suits and squirty flowers and dancing to Prince with a cane, and it's all good fun, but it is very, very heightened, and you know, teetering on being a little bit silly, but in a fun way. Obviously, Nolan came along, and that first film, Batman Begins, you know, it's such a gritty take and such a character-based take, and so much of its time dedicated to the training of Bruce Wayne, you know, before he becomes Batman. We take it for granted now, and we kind of forget just how radical that seemed. That this is 85 years of Batman, and this character's been around since the late 1930s, but it felt like a new, fresh take on it. So I love all the Nolan Batmans. You know, Dark Knight Rises, I think, is absolutely great as well, but people tend to think of it as the weaker one, maybe, or the lesser one of the trilogy. But just the scale and scope of it, it's so ambitious. You know, I think it's absolutely great. And then Matt Reeves' Batman, which I rewatched recently, I've now seen it three times. It may actually, this is a big, big statement, but it may actually be my favourite Batman movie now.
Bold claim.
It is a bold claim, but every time I've watched it, I've fallen in love with it a little bit more. And even though it's very much built on Nolan's Batman, and it's got that kind of real world grittiness underneath, it kind of does something different with it by focusing on Batman as a detective and being so moody and brooding and visually dark and, you know, just beautifully made. It's just got so much atmosphere that I just get completely wrapped up in it. I just love it. I think it's really great. And I really want to see that on the big screen again.
Yeah, I'd like to revisit that as well. And that's one of those films for me where, because I was just so invested in the Dark Knight trilogy, I had that weird thing where I almost didn't want someone to make more. I mean, obviously, they'll just keep making Batman stories till the end of time, because there's going to be like a version in the James Gunn, Peter Safran DCU as well, running alongside Robert Pattinson's. But I was a bit like, I was a bit dubious about another maybe. Yeah. And I was a bit like, you know, come on, this is the Dark Knight trilogy has such a special place in my heart. But so then I was surprised how much I enjoyed the Batman despite that, and part of that was because it kind of just felt like another well done Batman in the vein of the Dark Knight trilogy to me. So for that reason, I was just kind of happy to spend more time in that world, in a well done Batman film, basically.
I was going to say, the cinematography in that film, it's Greg Fraser, who did both the Dune movies and did Zero Dark 30. It's just absolute genius. And if it wasn't a Batman movie, you know, that should be winning the Oscar. It's such an amazing looking film, but kind of gets overlooked because it's Batman, but it's one of the best looking kind of blockbusters I've ever seen, without a doubt.
And just for me to go back onto the Dark Knight trilogy as well, pick up on what you were saying about Batman Begins, really. Honestly, lost count of how many times I've watched Batman Begins over the years. That's one that I think, again, now it's easy to look back on it and think, oh yeah, it's like it's Nolan. We kind of knew it was going to be great. We knew these films were going to be great, etc. But he obviously had that kind of, he had that crazy trajectory where he went from kind of, you know, super low budget film that showed a lot of potential to then showing what he could do with a modest budget and a star name and a cool idea, to then showing what he could do with like big names in a big Hollywood thriller, to then at a surprisingly young age, when you look back on it, like in his sort of early 30s, getting the keys to the Batman franchise. Every time I watch Batman Begins, I'm sort of struck again about just how confident it is and just how sort of lean it is, really, because the fact it just gets straight into it. And again, it's like cutting between different timelines, you know, to kind of tell this origin story, but it just does it so well. And there's literally just no fat on it at all. It's just, I just don't know how someone kind of did that basically at his stage of his career.
It feels really tough as well. Like the editing is really sort of jagged and, you know, it doesn't feel like a blockbuster. It doesn't feel sort of clean and safe. It's got an attitude to it, which again is maybe why he was so confident, because he knew after the Joel Schumacher Batmans and how silly and day-glow it got, you know, that it needed to be reinvented, and he really reinvented it. You know, it's such a back to basics approach, more so than even something like Casino Royale reinventing Bond. You know, it's gone so gritty that I think, you know, maybe he thought, I'm onto something here, and I'm just gonna go for it hell for leather, like, you know, take no prisoners.
I mean, again, I kind of forget this because of the time and everything, but this was before, it was just before Casino Royale as well. I think it was, because Batman Begins was 2005, and I think Casino Royale was in 2006. And I kind of remember people referring to that as like Bond Begins.
Yeah.
But then obviously everything tried for the gritty reboot afterwards, but none really succeeded.
Talking of, like I mentioned Nicholson a minute ago, I remember when that film came out in 1989. You know, I was a teenager and it's made such a cultural impact. It was absolutely everywhere. Everyone was wearing the T-shirts, the badges, all of that. And Nicholson was just lauded for that performance. People were going mad for it and saying he's going to win the Oscar and it's Jack Nicholson's greatest role and all this stuff at the time. And going back to see it now after what Heath Ledger did with it and how anarchic that is and how sort of nasty and scary sort of real world terrorism and deranged and all that, watching Nicholson again now, I actually found it just a bit cartoonish and a bit, you know, it didn't really do a lot for me now. So it's amazing the impact that Heath Ledger and Nolan had on this world.
And I kind of obviously touched on this earlier with Strange Darling in a way, where I said I felt really invigorated after that. I mean, we watch a lot of movies as part of our day job, you more than most, Jamie, but like if ever I need that reinvigoration feeling, or need to, you know, fall back in love with cinema, so to speak, I just need to get the Dark Knight trilogy on, basically.
Yeah,
I know that will just get my, you know, blood pumping and get me thinking, hell yes, this is why I love going to the cinema. I don't think re-releases get enough credit these days, especially, I mean, I suppose it's just people obviously always want to see something new at the cinema, but I love going to the cinema and paying, knowing that I'm not going to be disappointed with what I'm seeing, you know, because that's obviously always a slight gamble you take as a film fan, similar to being a, you know, a sports fan in many ways, I can imagine, I wouldn't know. But that's the thing, you obviously always hope a film will be great, and there's that amazing feeling when it is. But there is something nice about just knowing you're going to get your money's worth when you go.
That's why I do so many rewatches and give myself seasons, because it keeps my passion for cinema going. But, you know, I watch all the new films and you get great films, and I think films are as good as they've ever been. And every year I could give you a list of 50 amazing films that have come out that year across the globe. But around those 50 or even 100, whatever you want to say, there's an awful lot of mediocrity and rubbish. You know, it's very hard to make a good film. So I do watch a lot of stuff which, you know, doesn't really do it for me. So, and sometimes you get runs where you can have a couple of weeks where you just watch non-stop crap for 2 weeks. So, so I give myself seasons because it keeps my passion for cinema going. And you just remember how amazing films can be. And I also love the fact we now live in an age since COVID and stuff, with all the trouble cinemas have gone through, we now live in an age where, you know, re-releases are constant, where they've hit on something that, you know, every single week it seems you get, you know, a Tim Burton season, or you get Jaws, or you get Goodfellas, or you get something, you know, your local cinema is always replaying films. I've got my local cinema has got Carrie coming up and various others, and it's just fantastic. I just love going to a cinema. A lot of these movies I've only ever seen on video or DVD or TV, you know, grew up with, and just to go and see something like Goodfellas at the cinema is just incredible.
I'm Batman.
So we're almost at the end of the podcast now. What is your film of the week, Jamie, out of the new releases?
For me, it's a toss-up between The Substance and Strange Darling, both of which are absolutely great. If I absolutely had to choose one, I'd probably just give it to The Substance. But I must insist, if you can get to a cinema, you know, and you have the time, please go and see both, because they're both great and they both fully deserve your eyeballs.
Yeah, similar place to me, really. Strange Darling is probably slightly above it, just in terms of the surprise factor and, you know, catching me off guard like that. But then maybe I'd argue that if you can only see one on the big screen, maybe The Substance is the one to go for. But both very enjoyable films, which very much recommend if you've got the stomach for them. But yeah, so we're almost at the end of the podcast. So just a reminder that the Penguin issue is still out now, so you can read that to catch up ahead of the show starting this weekend. And remember, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. We always love hearing from you. And before we go, we're just going to answer one quick question, which is, what is your favourite movie witch, Jamie?
I'd have to go Dario Argento's Suspiria, one of my favourite horror movies, The Mother of Sighs. She is my favourite witch.
And I'm going to go for an obvious one, but I'm going to go for Angelica Houston's The Grand High Witch from The Witches, just because, one, that's just what springs to mind when I think of a movie witch. Two, just genuinely disturbing makeup by Jim Henson. I just find the whole story in a good way is very disturbing for children, like a lot of Roald Dahl stuff. I've revisited the book relatively recently. So yeah, that's front of mind for me. So hard to beat there for movie witches, but there's obviously loads of good ones. And
that is a terrifying children's film. Yeah. It doesn't get more scary than that for kids, I don't think.
But that's all from us for now. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.